This is The Takeaway for Monday, June 27th, 2016.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Oh, all those scattered pictures. Sing it, Barbara.
Pictures of the smiles we left behind. Smiles we gave to one another.
The way they were, the UK and the EU, remember.
This referendum on France's membership in the European Union is a democratic necessity. The French people must also be able to choose this right to liberty that would give France its full and whole sovereignty.
Can it be that it was all so simple then?
That's Marine Le Pen, leader of France's National Front Party. And like other nationalist voices in the EU, they are overjoyed at this split. In a moment, a look at the road ahead, the view from Paris and Berlin. But before you have a Brexit fatigue moment and run screaming to your isolationist corner, some thoughts from you on the big split. Ever had one? Some way we were memories now from you.
This is Jim in Dayton, Oregon. I left my boyfriend of 2 years who got drunk and took a swing at me. No regrets.
Hi, it's Hillary calling from California. I left the Army when my enlistment was over, but 13 years later, I still think and dream of the people that I served with. I don't regret leaving, but I miss the people.
My name is Julianne. I'm calling from Washington. I just left my job. Today is my first day away from my job, and I feel some regret and a lot of relief, but it's the best thing for my mental and physical health.
This is Patrick Gallagher from Hawaii, and in 1979, I left Columbia House Record Company. That was back when it was LPs and cassettes, and I have no regrets.
Austin, Texas told us, the Navy, I did 20 honorably and proud of it, still miss the lifestyle and challenges that came with operations. 877-8-MY-TAKE. Tell us your The Way We Were story or at thetakeaway.org. Joining me to discuss the way we were issues between the EU and the UK, the UK, by the way, that seems full of some regrets if names on online petitions to have another referendum over the weekend are any indication. The Paris view from Elaine Salino, former New York Times Paris bureau chief and author of The Only Street in Paris. And joining us from Bonn is Constanze Stelzenmüller, Robert Bosch Senior Fellow with the Center on United States and Europe at Brookings.
There is a difference of opinion in Germany on how to go forward. The foreign minister, Frank-Walter Steinmeier, on Saturday met with the foreign ministers of the five other founding countries of the EU, and they agreed with a position espoused earlier by EU heads, such as Mr. Juncker, the Commission President, saying that there was no way back and Britain should invoke Article 50, which will trigger the negotiations as quickly as possible. And indeed, what they are afraid of, and what the French in particular and others who have large populist movements are very afraid of, is a contagion effect. Now, Chancellor Merkel sees things differently, and her chief of staff as well, Peter Altmaier, they've made it very clear they want to take this slowly. They have suggested there might be a way of reversing the process even, and they are clearly against those who say, you know, there has to be a punishment here so that other people, such as the French populist leader and the Dutch populist leader, who've already called for a national referenda in their countries, France and the Netherlands, don't get inspired by this.
Does Angela Merkel have much to deal with Frau Capetri? And how would you gauge the political issues for Germany versus France and the Netherlands?
Sure. So Frau Capetri is the head of the populist movement that I just mentioned. And this populist movement sort of had a bit of an uptick a couple months ago when they got double-digit results in three regional elections, between 10 and slightly over 20%. But events since then have suggested they may have peaked, at least for the moment. They are riven by internal discord, Frau Capetri's leadership position being sought at on a daily basis. That said, of course, this party represents a popular mood. And it even though it is not in the federal legislature yet, people expect it to be come the next German elections in 2017. And they, like many populist parties in Europe and indeed in America, they're already constraining the space for public debate and action by policymakers and governments. So they are dangerous, but it's not quite on the level of France's Marine Le Pen with the Front National, who has polled much, much higher and whom I think President Hollande genuinely has to fear.
So, Elaine, is time on the side of the nationalists, whatever the economic consequences are of a quick exit?
Well, it's not just the nationalists. It's not just the far-right National Front that is in play here. You've got the center-right, former President Sarkozy. You've got the former Prime Minister Alain Juppé. You've got the former Agricultural Minister Bruno Le Maire. They all want to be president, and they all have different lines on what should be done. You know, Sarkozy is calling for an opportunity for a new start, whatever that means. Le Maire has actually asked for a referendum for a new treaty. These are not far right guys, although they are moving further to the right as France becomes more populist. This comes in a larger context of the French economy being in a very difficult situation with more than 10% unemployment. Employment laws are such that it's just too expensive to hire people. There are high social charges. And the fear of globalization goes back in France more than a decade. And let's not forget that in 2005, it was France that had its own referendum on Europe with the vote to either approve or not approve what was then a huge document called the European Constitution. And the French voted overwhelmingly to reject it. It was farmers, workers, unemployed, right, who said no. It also comes in the context of a real social cleavage after the terrorist attacks of last year in France, where the prime minister declared that France is separated by a territorial, social, and ethnic apartheid. And this is very dangerous, and this is what François Hollande is facing.
So both of you have described in very local terms what's happening here, and I like that, because over the weekend, I'd tell you, the back page of every newspaper and magazine seemed like a civics term paper or a PhD thesis on Europe going back to the 1930s and the entire 1945 order crumbling. What do you make of that, Elaine, and then Constance?
France wants to be the leader of Europe. France is in the euro. Right now, the best thing that could happen is for Hollande and Merkel to come up with some sort of modus operandi and work together to preserve Europe. It's going to take real leadership, and leadership that's not easy, because it's not easy to sell the European experiment project to people who don't have jobs, who, farmers who are losing subsidies, who are not able to make a living, for young people who can't get jobs here in France. And we're hoping to go to England. Don't forget, London was the promised land, the holy grail for so many French people, young French people who can't get jobs here.
Well, London as the Emerald City notwithstanding, Constance, what do you make of this deep psychological, let's go back to the Europe of the 1800s idea that was on the back pages all the weekend long?
Dissolution of the European Union is not an option. We are so deeply integrated with each other, legally, factually, socially, economically, politically, it's unimaginable. And in my view, the British have been pursuing a delusion of sovereignty and control. This will be horribly painful for them. One can only feel terribly, terribly sorry. But I'm sure that Merkel and others will do what it takes to keep this together.
Constance Stelzenmüller is Robert Bosch Senior Fellow with the Center on the United States and Europe at Brookings. And Elaine Solino is former New York Times Paris bureau chief and author of The Only Street in Paris. Elaine, Constance, thanks so much.
You're very welcome.
Thank you. Pleasure.
Over the weekend, the Democratic Party began to feel nostalgia and started drafting its official policy platform, the first opportunity to gauge the clout of the Bernie Sanders movement. Remember that? That made the primary campaign difficult for presumptive Democratic presidential nominee Hillary Clinton. What do you think? Is Senator Sanders crowing here?
We won some very, very important victories in our effort to try to make it clear to the American people that the Democratic Party stands with the middle class, stands with working families, and is prepared to take on Wall Street and the big money interest. But we lost some very important fights. We're going to take that fight to Orlando, where the entire committee meets in 2 weeks. And if we don't succeed there, we're certainly going to take it to the floor of the Democratic Convention.
Senator Sanders on CNN's State of the Union over the weekend. Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick, welcome.
Hi, John.
So I can't quite figure it out. Sanders says he's voting for Hillary Clinton, but it's not an endorsement?
It's not the kind of endorsement that Hillary Clinton's going to need from Bernie Sanders if she wants to make sure that she shores up all of that progressive energy in the general election that she's going to need. So even myself talking to a lot of Democrats over the weekend about this draft platform and about the relationship now between Sanders and Clinton, many of them, Clinton supporters, of course, disappointed that Sanders hasn't endorsed yet, but says that just has to come at the convention when he speaks. They need the word endorsement out of his mouth. And many of them think that the concessions now that Sanders has gotten in this draft platform is going to help with that. Let me tell you what Sanders has won in pushing the Democratic platform to a more progressive, more left place than it's ever been, according to him. The $15 minimum wage, John, is in there. Now, Hillary Clinton, as you know, is only for $12. So that's a Sanders concession. There are steps in that platform toward breaking up big banks that are too big to fail. They call it the new Glass-Steagall language. That's in the Democratic platform. And it also now calls for the abolition of the death penalty, something Hillary Clinton favors in certain circumstances. John, Bernie Sanders didn't get a lot of things, and he lost in some key areas here. There is no ban on hydraulic fracking that the Sanders campaign desperately wanted. There's no calls for a carbon tax, even though there is some strong language on climate change, as you can imagine. Bernie Sanders wants to expand Medicare into national single-payer health care, and the platform does not call for that because it still calls for building on the successes of Obamacare. And here's the big one, trade, TPP. We have all seen Sanders' strong position against TPP, and Hillary Clinton is now against TPP after being for it in Obama's first term. However, that draft document, that platform, John, does not call for the overturning of TPP, and they just couldn't do it. Why? Because Barack Obama's for it, and they don't want a Democratic Party platform that goes directly against the interests and the policies of the president as he leaves office. It does have language in there saying you have to protect workers' rights and the environment and some of the things that you might expect.
Well, they're also trying to preempt Donald Trump, who's big on this whole trade thing. I think we should note that Bernie Sanders, for all his crowing, didn't get living wage, maybe $15 an hour, but he didn't get living wage, and that was a big issue with him.
Yeah, no, it definitely was, although I think he can claim at least the rhetorical victory here because 15 was the number throughout the campaign that Sanders did glom onto, and he got that in the platform. The question, does that ever go to a congressional vote where they get a $15 national minimum wage? Would a President Clinton sign that? That's one for the future, and that's the difference between party platforms and making laws, John.
Well, no raise for you, Todd. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, funding research so patients do more than survive, they live their lives. Learn more at lls.org.
The acquittal in what was believed to be the most plausible case against a Baltimore police officer last week in the death of Freddie Gray did not cause the city to erupt in protest and violence, even though TV channel MSNBC couldn't resist rerunning riot pictures from last year over the headline "Happening Now" in its coverage of the verdict. In all of the cases of police violence around the country, shock and anger have given way to a stronger community voice in most cases, tentative trust in some cases, and a more proactive police strategy seeking outreach to the community before, not after, tragedies occur. And we can only hope in some law enforcement cases. But still, as the federal government tries to enforce police reform around the nation, the question remains how to effectively police the police. In 2014, the Department of Justice concluded that police in Newark, New Jersey were, quote, engaging in a pattern or practice of unconstitutional stops, searches, arrests, and use of excessive force by officers, which had a disparate impact on minorities, end quote. How does a ruling like that lead to reform? Jelani Cobb, staff writer for The New Yorker, is the reporter and anchor for Frontline's new investigation, Policing the Police, which uses Newark as a case study in how challenging reform can actually be from the department's perspective. Jelani Cobb, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
So what did they let you see? What did you get to look at?
So it's interesting because we had a kind of extended negotiations in order to get access, and kind of once we got in, we were on patrol with officers. We were talking to people who were in the police infrastructure. We talked with people who are trying to institute reform there, with the people on the DOJ side. And I think we got kind of a top-to-bottom perspective. We also talked to community organizations and neighborhood watch groups. And so I think we got a good cross-section of, you know, the perspectives on policing in Newark.
And your access to the police seemed pretty good. I mean, you were impressed by that.
Eventually. We had some obstacles that we had to kind of navigate in terms of dealing with getting access to the police, yeah.
Well, and indeed, that's part of the story. Yeah. Here's a sample of what you were able to observe.
How old are you?
13.
All right, so would you
keep walking.
That's what we have to deal with in the city of Newark. 13-year-olds. Talk back to police.
Do you think he was justified to be worried about his brother?
Oh, absolutely. But he sees who we are. We're police. Yeah. Shouldn't be afraid of police.
I could hear you in there. What's going on? You're in a car or you're on the street?
We're in a car, and the police have just pulled over and kind of stopped and frisked a 10-year-old. And the 10-year-old's 13-year-old brother is concerned about him. He's, you know, saying, you know, he's just 10. I think the officer did not seem to recognize how traumatizing that could be for someone. And I think what was disturbing about that interaction was that once we pulled off, you know, of course, there was nothing illicit, you know, that the 10-year-old had in his possession. But once we pulled off, they said, you know, well, people give drugs to, you know, little kids, and they want them to hold them because they know that they won't get serious penalties if they're found to have them, have drugs in their possession, which may well happen. You know, this is, you know, Newark police. I'm sure they may have encountered something like that. But there's always the presumption that if someone doesn't have anything illegal on them, they must have ditched it or stashed it, or there's no kind of recognition that what you just did very likely was stop and search a 10-year-old.
And part of the challenge, the toughness of the ways in which law enforcement clings to this idea of we're kind of right no matter what, and there is no presumption of innocence on the street, is seen in this particular confrontation. You asked a question here. We'll listen to the answer, and I think we can get a sense of what you are asking.
He pulled out his weapon to make you comply with whatever he needed you to do at the time for his safety and other officers' safety, even for your own safety.
You could point your weapon at somebody and give them commands to comply. Once you feel like the threat's neutralized, like, you know, they're complying with you, then you put your weapon away and, you know, have a normal interaction.
We've had kind of a dueling dialogue here, where one part of the conversation is saying people really don't understand how difficult it is for police. And having spent almost a year in Newark, I am sympathetic to that idea that it is a phenomenally difficult job and a phenomenally difficult job to do well. But the other side of it is that I think that it is very often difficult for these officers to imagine what it is like to be on the other side of an interaction with them.
Well, you ask a question that is really the big question here. Are we moving towards something that's going to resolve this, or are we just going around in circles? And here's an example of you really asking the big question in this whole investigation.
Can this be done in a way that still respects people's rights?
Absolutely.
I think that's the question that everybody is wondering about policing.
So we try to go out there and respect everybody's rights.
Exactly.
We're not out here saying, hey, we're going to violate this person's rights. That's not what we're here for.
You wind up with situations where people's rights are being violated. And that kind of interaction was exactly a kind of microcosm of what we just saw with the Supreme Court with the Strife case, where Justice Sotomayor wrote that really, really eloquent dissent from the idea that someone could be, you know, searched under illegal circumstances, but then evidence that's found could be still admissible in court. And you know, what I realized when I was having that conversation with officers about whether or not they could police in a place like Newark without violating people's rights, and just so we say, so we're clear what we're talking about here, we're talking about stops where officers would pull someone's waistband away from their body and look down at their genitals to see if they had a weapon, just kind of randomly walking down the street, and the next thing you know, there's someone looking at your private parts. that level of invasive search. What I realized is that the officers and I were talking past each other. Like, their conception of people's rights was so narrow that unless they had done something completely egregious, they didn't believe anyone's rights had been violated.
In American cultural terms, I mean, is this an issue of, you know, sensitive lefties versus kind of pragmatic, practical right-wing folks, and, and that's just the way it's going to be? Or does everybody have to go to some kind of civics class, I mean, to get on the same page as far as what the Constitution even means?
There actually is a Fourth Amendment, and I think that we should be mindful of it and protective of it. And at the same time, there are real concerns with crime. We talk about that there, homicide and violence in the city, and people are really concerned about that. And there has to be some way to find a middle ground between the two of them. But one of the things about Newark was that, you know, they are, and they have leadership there that is really invested in the idea of saying that they can find some different way of approaching these things.
Do you trust that?
Listen to you. So here, I had an exchange with the mayor of the city, Raz Baraka, and he said, if I didn't believe that these things could be better, why would I bother to get out of bed in the morning? I thought that was a really good kind of concise explanation of what I would guess is a realistic optimism, that things can change, but they will probably be very difficult to change, and it'll take a long time.
Well, great, great voice as a narrator and a questioner and a journalist here in this Frontline, which is fabulous piece of documentary. Jelani Cobb, staff writer for The New Yorker. You can watch the Frontline investigation, Policing the Police, airing Tuesday night. Frontline is produced by our partner station, WGBH. Thanks so much, Jelani.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International, in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
In a bit of, shall we say, transparency for its state clean water policy, the Florida Department of Environmental Protection now wants to increase the levels of toxins permissible in the water. The decision affects 65,000 square miles of a state that is nearly 19% water covered. The decision affects lake and river recreational uses and drinking water. Drew Bartlett, the Deputy Secretary for Ecosystem Restoration at the Florida Department of Environmental Protection, says this is not a murky decision. It's more like a scientific update.
We are not in any way changing the level of protection for any of these chemicals. What you do is you take what we know about how people eat, how they swim, how they bathe, how they drink. You take the latest toxicology data out of EPA's science. And then you pair that with that exposure frequency, and you set the number to protect all of Floridians.
But given the way in which the people of Flint, Michigan lost all trust in the authorities controlling their contaminated drinking water, Jessica Mazzaros, reporter for WGCU in Fort Myers, Florida, and local host of All Things Considered, says everyone is proceeding cautiously.
Well, here's the thing. It's not just fresh water. It's also brackish water, you know, mixed with salt and fresh. So the Florida Department of Environmental Protection wants to increase allowable levels of about 20 toxins it regulates in Florida's surface waters. These are waters like wetlands, estuaries, rivers. So basically any body of water you can see. It regulates 43 chemicals overall right now, and these levels haven't been updated since the 1990s. The point of contention is that some of these toxins the DEP wants to increase are known to cause cancer, like chloroform and benzene.
And Dr. Lonnie Draper, who's an emergency physician in Tallahassee and president of Physicians for Social Responsibility, has this reaction.
It is a well-established and known carcinogen. Benzene is a part of a component of the extraction of fossil fuels, so it's in oil, there's small amounts in coal, and it's in natural gas in small quantities, but it's also a byproduct from a number of industries. The extraction of natural gas using fracking has a waste component to it of benzene.
So Lonnie Draper accuses the DEP of having ulterior motives for upping allowable benzene levels to help the fracking industry. And as he mentioned, it's a method of extracting oil and natural gas. It shoots high-pressured water, sand, and chemicals into limestone rock. And it's a highly debated issue in Florida because it's unknown how much of those chemicals would get into the state's groundwater. And at least for the past two legislative sessions, state lawmakers have tried and failed to pass regulations that would essentially pave the way for fracking in the state. But it's known that some 30 counties and nearly 50 cities have either opposed fracking or have banned it altogether. But actually, Drew Bartley with the DEP says raising allowable benzene levels in Florida's surface waters is in no way related to fracking because we're talking about surface waters and fracking happens underground.
Okay, there is absolutely no connection between oil and gas exploration and these chemicals. These chemicals apply, like I said, to the surface water body. Oil and gas exploration, where it happens in the state of Florida, is 2 to 3 miles below the surface.
Drew Bartlett, again, that's Deputy Secretary for Ecosystem Restoration at the Florida Department of Environmental Protection. Okay, he says there's no connection. The environmentalists, including Dr. Draper, who we just heard from, says that benzene and to raise benzene, allowable benzene in water, has immediate health effects because benzene is a carcinogen. What motivated this change? What happened that causes the state to think we need to really review these levels?
So after speaking with Drew Bartlett, he says these are not random numbers that the agency just came up with. He says these are based on guidelines the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency released last year. He also says these new numbers do not lower protections for people against toxins. So he says that they've done the math and that in no way lowers protections for people. But it is increasing this toxin. And Lonnie Draper just says basically the more you increase harmful toxins in water, the more likely people will be exposed to it and the more likely they'll get sick from it. And he says it's just the math himself.
What is the assurance from the oil and gas industry that, in fact, as the demand for fossil fuels increases and the effectiveness of fracking encourages more and more development of oil and gas resources in the Gulf and in Florida, that there won't be increased levels and that this sudden change in the allowable toxins won't look like some sort of insurance policy that the industry had put in place for them?
Well, it's hard to say right now. Like we're having this back and forth conversation of like it is about fracking. It's not about fracking. And, you know, all I can say is the DEP says this is strictly about surface waters and fracking happens underground. So then they're not related at all. However, we don't know how much of the fracking chemicals would actually get into the groundwater and then spread. It's an unknown situation right now.
So what's next for the Department of Environmental Protection?
So now a commission within the DEP, it's called the Florida Environmental Regulation Commission. It would have to approve these updates, and it's expected to take up the issue this fall. It's important to note that the commission is made up of members appointed by Governor Rick Scott. Now, the DEP proposed updates to these chemicals in 2013 that did not go through, so it is unclear how this proposal will pan out. If the commission does pass this increase to chemicals, it will then go to the feds for approval, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, the same agency the DEP says it based these numbers on in the first place.
Jessica Mazzaro is reporter for WGCU and host of All Things Considered at WGCU in Fort Myers, Florida. Thanks so much, Jessica.
Glad to be here.
It's so hard to say goodbye.
Markets across the world are down again after the UK voted to leave the European Union. Did you ever have a big breakup?
Hi, this is Lisa from New York. I left my abusive first husband after he admitted to killing one of our cats. The only regret is that I didn't leave him sooner. He went on to marry another woman who divorced him, and then he came out of the closet. It was a waste of time, energy, money, a lot of money, and a lot of soul.
Olympia Washington told us this story. I moved away from the area where I grew up. My regret is that I ranted to my mom all the reasons I felt I wanted to move, all the negatives about the area that would prevent me from moving back. My dear mom, who was there wishing I would come back to her region where she'd grown up and was so beloved to her. It hurt her badly. I wasn't thinking about her feelings, and it is a huge disappointment to me that I was so thoughtless. She forgave me. Of course, she was your mom, but I haven't. Thanks for the story. 877-8-MY-TAKE is our number. Comment at facebook.com/thetakeaway.
And I'll take you.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. A look now at how the city of Spokane, Washington, is a case study in taking steps to improve the dropout rate in its community. In 2006, Spokane County reported an overall 19.8% dropout rate, while the state as a whole was at 5.7%. The county decided to take action, and a decade later, the change has been dramatic. The Takeaway sent Washington-based reporter Angela Nguyen to Spokane County to see how those changes are working in one school district.
It feels like I grew up here. I don't know how to describe that really, but it definitely feels like a part of me still here.
That's Destiny DeHamer.
You'd go here for attendance, then here, then there's stairs that go upstairs.
Do you want to peek inside that classroom?
Yeah.
We're at Central Valley High School, part of the Central Valley School District located in Spokane County. Destiny graduated from here in 2014. By that time, the county dropout rate had already decreased drastically to 10.2%. cut by more than half from what it was 8 years before. Melissa Scott is a counselor at McDonald Elementary.
Well, I think it's a really caring environment, and I think that there is a focus on the whole child. We've done a lot of research in regard to what things need to be in place to support students and families so that they can be successful and just learn as much as they can.
Studies show increasing student success has positive impacts, not only on education, but also the overall community health. In 2009, an organization run by local representatives of the county called Priority Spokane took steps to make education the main focus of the community.
We have a truancy board that has been in place now for a couple years to help students and families just be in school. There's a proactive student intervention team that was formed maybe 4 or 5 years ago, and then they created several interventions for students in many different areas for their families as well.
Data from the Spokane Regional Health District released in 2012 showed a correlation between parents' education levels and their children's poverty levels. The higher the level of education the parent received, the lower the likelihood of their child's poverty.
Since we have such a high level of students that come from low socioeconomic status, we've had book studies or professional development on working with children that come from backgrounds of poverty.
That's Aaron Dahlgren.
I teach third grade here at McDonald Elementary School.
His whole teaching career has been inside Title I schools like McDonald Elementary that aim to close gaps between students regardless of their socioeconomic status. Aaron says getting to understand who the students are is key in being able to help them.
At the classroom level, it really starts with a relationship. I think it starts on the very first day of school. So many teachers here at our school go to baseball games, go to dance recitals, go to whatever the kids have going on outside of school just to build that relationship and find something that we can get in common with them.
Back at Central Valley High School, Stanley Chalich teaches civics, and for more than 45 years, he's made a career of doing just that. Do you remember Destiny?
Yes, I do. Very, very nice kid. And I've known the family for quite some time. But no, she was a fantastic girl.
Personally, I had him for psychology my sophomore year and then civics my senior year. He pretty much knows everybody in Spokane.
Not only does Mr. Chalich know the students, he even remembers things about their families.
The grandpa was a custodian here at Central Valley High School.
This hallway is significant to me, probably for a pretty weird reason, but if you walk all the way down, and then on your right, it's the janitor's closet. And my grandpa was the head custodian my freshman year, so I would come have lunch with him down here. But yeah, that's a good memory.
Those details are what's kept Mr. Chalich passionate about being in the classroom for so many years.
That's why I'm in education. You know, if you care, and I use that word, all kids, you know, I says, I love all of you. You know what I mean by love all of you? I care about you.
The care and the time that the teachers put in was most definitely one of the reasons that I excelled here. Because if they didn't care, then why should I care?
Destiny credits that whole student approach for how she excelled at Central Valley High School. She's now starting her third quarter at Spokane Community College for an associate's degree and plans to transfer to a four-year university. For The Takeaway, I'm Angela Nguyen.
The Takeaway's Zip Code Decoded series is supported in part by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation.
As the school goes, so goes the health of the Spokane community.
The school system is a perfect setting to actually really have some impact in interventions.
Lyndia Wilson, the division director at Spokane Regional Health District, says that's the lesson from a decade of trying to raise graduation rates. Wilson says school data has had an unexpected impact on monitoring community health.
We're a very data-driven organization, and we really have been focusing on graduation rates, But also the research has really pointed to kids who are absent a lot, have behavioral issues, and have failing grades in those core classes.
Do they view your interest in what's going on with them as a, you know, sort of truancy enforcement? Or how do you get them to understand that, no, this is about your health, this is about really your whole future?
Well, the projects that we've been working on is really focused in the middle school. And before they're actually considered a truant kid, so they're absent maybe four unexcused absences. And what between the partnership between the community and the schools, we really look at what's going on with the child and the family, bring them together in a supportive setting, and really try to figure out what is it that's going on and how can we help them improve that attendance issue.
What kind of problems have you solved? I mean, without telling any names, of course, give me an indication of what interventions came up and how you solved them.
There's a variety of issues going on with families. Some kids are bullied, so they don't want to go to school. They don't feel safe being there. Some home issues could have parents incarcerated. There's been health issues where a mom actually was dying. A lot of family life issues that interfere with academics.
How much does a reluctance of people to share those kinds of details, that sometimes can be very painful, interfere with your ability to carry out these best practices?
I think there's always that caution with students and families when they come to the school. It's a very supportive environment, though, and they can really tell that the counselors and the teachers and the community really care about them. And so usually by the end of the session, they've opened up and they really are seeing that it's not going to be punitive or they're not going to get in trouble, but it's really that supportive environment.
Are your teachers reporters on the ground, and do they buy into this program?
The teachers are very involved with the program. The school counselors even more so, because they're usually the ones that really hear about some of the home issues. Our school system that we've been working with has been very supportive of this project. I think, you know, the schools have so much going on, and they're trying to really teach these kids. But with all these family issues, they realize that they really need this community support and outside assistance. So the referrals and the sessions may be to a mental health counselor. It may be helping them with some rent. There's a variety of systems that are set up in place to help these families in the community.
Is there an outcome, a goal that you really want to meet over the next 2 to 5 years?
We're hoping to get the graduation rate up to 90%. That's always been kind of our goal. We are sitting around 82-83% right now, and we know that this last 7-15% is going to be more difficult. They're kids that have a lot of things going on in their lives, and poverty is one big one where they just don't have the resources, and the family is struggling in a lot of different ways.
Lyndia Wilson is the division director at Spokane Regional Health District. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And here's something to take with you today. He was named a living landmark of the city of New York in 2006. And because he never stopped moving when he worked, there may never be a landmark plaque for Bill Cunningham. The world's greatest people watcher of all time is no longer with us. New York Times fashion photographer Bill Cunningham died over the weekend at the age of 87. Cunningham's age never prejudiced his keen eye for fashion trends and the genius of people, regular folks, putting it all together. Cunningham's only concession to fashion himself was a light blue shirt and his bicycle, from which he spotted the images that ended up on the film of his 35mm camera. Nearly 40 years working for the Times, Mr. Cunningham snapped millions of pictures. You can only hope that you and that fantastic shirt and hat combo was one of them. Bill Cunningham, we wish you well. And that's all for today. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International. On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.